guys, it's Nathan, doing the one thing I promised I'd never do, which is a semi-solo pod, but that's just going to be the first half of this episode. In the back half, Aaron and I have been working on comparing our top 100 lists. We're going position by position because it's just crazy to start off 1 through 100. So the back half of this will be us comparing our top point guards that we believe have a case to be on a top 100 list. But with everything going on in the NBA, I just kind of wanted to touch on things real quickly. First off, this podcast has not had a chance to address the Sarver findings. Basically, the NBA found out everything the Baxter Holmes article from ESPN last year was true. And initially, the push to have him suspended for a year and a $10 million fine is really light work. I 100% agree with all of the criticism. It was not enough, but I also do recognize that per some of the reporting by Andrew Sharp of the GOAT podcast, that's probably all they could do. Their hands are kind of tied as one of the owners of the franchise. That's the maximum punishment the commissioner could levy. I am super excited for everyone in the Mercury and Suns organization that Sarver has agreed to sell. It does suck that he will continue to be a shitty person and make billions of dollars on this sale. I do really appreciate some of the reporting that points out that while he is the majority owner, he owns a smaller share than most majority owners, so it might not be as much money unless everyone is forced to sell in the deal. Hopefully Phoenix can get a really good owner who's going to invest in the franchise and make them a dominant powerhouse. We have seen Phoenix get some pretty high-profile free agents, or at least get interviews with high-profile free agents. They haven't necessarily landed them all, but they're at least in the conversation. I think if you get the right ownership team in there, someone who's going to spend, the next Steve Ballmer, whoever that might be, that could be really good. I think an under-discussed thing is that the Portland Trailblazers could also be for sale soon, which you don't usually see two NBA teams for sale at the same time. That could decrease the value of the Suns, or at least, you know, you got multiple teams on the market. Maybe the buyers aren't as likely to pay top dollar. Second big piece of NBA news recently is Ime Udoka getting suspended by the Boston Celtics for a year for having what has been described as a consensual but inappropriate relationship with a team staffer. It does seem a bit extreme to suspend a person for an entire year, but this is workplace harassment policies. I highly encourage anybody that has a job to check what your workplace relationship guidelines say about this thing. I met my wife at the company that we both worked at. We were at the same level, but I pretty quickly moved on to a higher position where I was responsible for making recommendations and calls of who got special projects that directly affected her work. It was required that we tell people and our bosses and everyone that was kind of involved in the situation that we were dating. We did, and there were absolutely no problems for us. However, there were other couples within the company where a boss would date a subordinate, and they did have some problems in the company. People had been reassigned, people were demoted, there was a lot of things that could go wrong, and they were all within our workplace guidelines. We don't know the exact relationship, who this woman was, what happened, whether it was fully consensual, whether it was not, where they're at in the org chart. There's been rumors that she was a VP. There's been rumors that there were multiple women. There was a report that it started consensual and then she feared retaliation when she tried to end things. There's a lot that goes into this, but simply put, there's a workplace rules for relationships which were not followed. Now, how this will affect Boston's season? That's going to be interesting because they are coming into the year as the title favorites, at least according to the Vegas betting odds. I do think that was probably always a little bit of an overstatement, kind of a overreaction to how they performed last year. But I think even without Ime, they will still be able to compete for the conference finals, but I do think this caps their ceiling. Also, already having a Robert Williams injury on the books is not a good sign, and having Gallo out for the season, they're really lacking a lot of depth up front. So it is super disappointing to come off of that great finals run, having the burgeoning star in Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown looking great as well, but sorry, Boston Celtics are getting set back a year. We've also seen a few minor signings. The Lakers picking up Dennis Schroeder. While I like the Schroeder-Avery Bradley combo, I'm not sure that you can do a three-guard combo. I feel like it's going to be way too small, not enough defensive prowess. So could this mean Westbrook has moved to the bench? Possibly. I certainly don't expect him to be in closing lineups, but a Westbrook with Schroeder, some other shooters out there, maybe a Thomas Bryant to have a little bit of size and shooting, could be a decent unit kind of when you want to rust LeBron. But more interestingly, Philadelphia's signing Montrezl Harrell is just an amazing pickup. He is one of the best pick and roll bigs, and when you need to sit Embiid, he can really help fill in some of the offense. His playoff limitations are going to be diminished in Philadelphia because you can play PJ Tucker at the five. All Harrell needs to do is be able to be a 20 to 25 minute a night big man, play some pick and roll during the regular season, help keep that offense afloat when Joel is out. And this was kind of my worry with PJ Tucker as the five man and the backup five on this team was I feel like you were going to need a lot of PJ Tucker during the regular season. And this just gives them a just free reign to rest PJ Tucker. PJ is going to be able to play like 15 minutes a night during the regular season, save up everything, and then boom, come playoffs, you can ramp him up to 30, and it's just going to be really good. It's a super small move, but I do think that this elevates them in the contender conversation. You know, I think Boston falling, Philadelphia on the rise. Like, I still have Milwaukee as the number one, but I'm pretty close to who Philadelphia as a 1B for getting out of the East this year. Meanwhile, at the bottom of the conferences, the tank race has already begun. Spurs have ruled out Keldon Johnson for the first little bit. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is out for the first bit, as well as Chet will potentially miss the entire season. Even Orlando just announced that Markel Fultz is going to miss some time. Utah, you know, took pennies on the dollar to get rid of Bojan, which is going to be a nice piece in Detroit. At least it's nice to see Detroit going for it. I doubt he will be there throughout the end of the year. He's definitely getting moved at the deadline, whether it's for a couple of seconds, if you can get a bad first for him. But Utah moving him for this week of a package really says Utah's going all in for the tank. Watch out for a Mike Conley move. They're going to give up anybody that could possibly help them. But yeah, I really just wanted a quick rundown of what's been going on in the league and get some quick thoughts on the board. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. This is Aaron and I debating which point guards stand a chance of making the top 100. We're just ranking them as best we see fit for the moment. We will re-rank everyone when we get to the top 100, but it's a lot easier to rank position by position. So hope you enjoy this chat. Yeah, I really wanted to start like the top 100 discussion with like a position by position, because like debating, hey, is Tracy McGrady better or worse than Patrick Ewing or like Bernard King or Dame? Like when you have all of them and every option available, it gets so hard. But then if we're like, all right, here's the top of each list, then we just have the, like the one of five. Then it gets easier. It's not endless possibilities.
We can kind of break it down. We can see who's next on that positional tier. I have 22 point guards, kind of more than I anticipated. I feel like all of these guys could be a top 100 player if you make the right case.
Yeah. I start off with the matrix and just like, all right, what does my matrix say? Where do I agree and disagree with it? And I loved its rankings for the shooting guards. The point guards just has this like really messed up cluster. But who is your number one point guard? Well, actually, number one's boring. Number one's Magic. Number two is Curry. If you put Jerry West as a point guard, he's listed as shooting guard half places point guard, but he's number three. And then Oscar's number four.
I have Oscar number three.
You have Oscar number three over West.
I totally do. This is great.
Break it down.
I feel like Oscar's offensive output is kind of understated. No one else has ever replicated what he was able to do. He's both the most efficient guard in the league. He's the highest scoring guard in the league, and he is leading the league in assists over and over and over and over again. I think he's top two for like basically essentially his entire prime in assists per game per season. No one else has the production and the efficiency like he does. He's just a machine. We've never seen it replicated.
Does the lack of playoff success and the fact that his team never was really all that good with him being this unstoppable offensive juggernaut affect you?
It holds him back because talent-wise and production-wise, he's in the top 10. He probably is higher than that all time, but without that playoff success, it pretty much halts him from being past. I think I have Durant number 13 and Oscar number 14 all time. And that's kind of a pretty substantial gap there because of that lack of playoff success. And really, if you look at the teams or his teammates, it's not great. He has Jerry Lucas for a bit, but really he's kind of playing with the end of 50s guys for the beginning of his career, kind of like the old Rochester Royals, and the red like West gets Elgin Baylor, Wilt gets his guys and whatnot, and Oscar kind of gets stuck with mediocre help.
See, the thing for me with West is like the Lakers era. I feel like this is one of the most misunderstood things about the 60s basketball is people think of the Lakers as being West, Baylor, and Wilt. And it's more like Baylor, a little bit of West and Baylor. Baylor gets hurt and becomes a truly diminished player. Then at the end of their careers, all three, like the three have like one good season together.
It's very brief.
Yeah. It's not like Bill beat the three of them combined. It's the three of them were fairly separated out. And I was just, I pulled up the 65 playoffs where Baylor played 5 minutes and West took the Lakers to the finals, averaging 40 points per game during the playoffs. Like that's to me why I have Jerry West over Oscar, is because he took his team to the finals without the help. Oscar was kind of struggling to make the playoffs and finally gets a ring at the end. But they do come in 12th and 14th in the matrix, and actually Oscar is ahead of West, so I'm kind of bucking the norm here.
You're going against the science that brought you here. Something really impressive is Oscar does come one game away from going to the finals and beating the Celtics, the 63 Celtics. And, you know, beating Russell at this point is unheard of. He's going to go on to win another five rings after this. In that series, Oscar Robertson is 33 points a game, 12 rebounds, 8.5 assists on 48% shooting. He's really just unstoppable.
And the game seven dropped 43 points. So
yeah, played well.
Although Sam Jones had 47. That's a nice game from Sam Jones. I might have to move up my shooting guard rankings.
I'm a big Sam Jones supporter.
I'm fine leaving it with Oscar at three and West at four. The world has forgotten how good Jerry West is, and I will take any chance I get to argue with it.
I think there is a huge drop off from West to the next tier of point guards.
Absolutely. Just looking matrix wise, from number 32 in the matrix to 43 in the matrix, we have seven different point guards. So like a really tight cluster. We're talking 12 spots, seven point guards, and then two more hit 49 and 50. But like that 32 to 50 range, just so many point guards. And I was actually kind of surprised at how much I moved up some guys and moved some guys down. Who do you have as that fifth best point guard?
I ended up going with Chris Paul.
Same.
I think it's the right decision. He's the point guard.
You know, I was just really looking at guys and I was like, all right, because that range includes Nash and Kidd. And I was like, all right, Paul has better defense than both of them. Arguably as good of offensive Nash. And as good a passing as Kidd. Like, no, he doesn't have the MVPs. He didn't have the finals runs that Kidd had. And part of that is the lack of playoff success. Listen, maybe that can be attributed to his bad injury luck history, which maybe I should hold that more against him. You know, the fact that he was never healthy or his teammates were never healthy. But I feel like there's not a lot of differentiation between him and the guy that I've got ranked 13th for point guards.
It's super close. If you took Chris Paul number five and shuffled him all the way down with number 13, I really wouldn't bat an eye. The thing with Paul is, I understand like Kidd goes to the finals. Chris Paul could have taken the Nets to the finals.
Yeah.
It's not like, those Nets teams are not fantastic. It's not something to say like, well, you know, it's something I applaud Kidd for doing, but at the same time.
The West was incredibly dominant. I think the second round teams in the West probably would have beat the East. So it's cool that he makes the finals. But I don't feel like saying, he's the best player to make on a two-time finals team isn't like fully accurate, or it's a little misleading of a statement.
I never like when people just crown, well, he got to the finals and Chris Paul never did, or he won an MVP and Chris Paul never did. Like there's levels to this. Like there is a difference between accomplishing and production. Who do you have number six? I could talk about this. If I ever meet, we meet somebody and they know about basketball, I'm just going to ask, who is your 5 through 13th best point guards ever? It's the most interesting conversation you can have.
For six, I went with Cousy.
Ooh, I like it. I had Isaiah Thomas, but I do have Cousy 7th, and I'm okay with putting him up there.
I had Isaiah 7th, which is really a surprise for me because the numbers don't like Isaiah Thomas, and he's always rated pretty poorly in the matrix, or like poorer than I would have expected. But when I'm just lining these guys up side by side, of like, hey, who could be the best player on a championship team? And Cousy, I will argue that Cousy potentially was the best player on in the 57 championship team. It was pointed out to me that Bill Russell missed half the season, or not half, like the first 20 games of the season to compete. Cousy was MVP. Cousy was MVP. Someone pointed out that Bill was missing, and they're like, yeah, once Bill showed up, he was going to be MVP. But I just, Cousy did a lot. And like, Cousy was MVP. Cousy was actually a really great scorer. I know his field goal percentage is terrible, but, you know, if you dive into the numbers and look at league field goal percentage and true shooting, he's actually pretty decent relative to the era, as well as being an elite passer. I mean, he leads the playoffs in assists 8 times. Like, I don't know. Just
8 straight times. And he also leads the playoffs in assists per game 8 straight times as well. Another thing to note, Bob Cousy has 3 third... Wait. I'm reading the wrong thing. Has 2 second place finishes in points per game in 1954 and 1955. It's a world where he has scoring titles.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I think really, relative to era, Cousy is just miles ahead of anyone else playmaking wise. So, like, you know, and he's like, hey guys, you know, you can run with the basketball, like, watch this.
You can go behind your back, you can use both hands. Like, I love the whole like bag community of like, hey, Kyrie's got the biggest bag, and I'm like, that doesn't mean anything. Like, he's got all of these skills, all these tricks, but what is he doing with them? And what Bob Cousy was doing with them was winning championships and like pushing the game forward. Kyrie's over here kind of goofing off and got lucky to be with LeBron for a little bit. Like, it's a different level. So that's my argument for Cousy is 6.
What holds Cousy back on my all-time rankings is he doesn't win anything until Russell gets there. Him and Bill Sharman are there for a long time before Russell shows up, and they really don't. There's no finals appearances. They're just kind of there. The defense is always really bad, and then obviously having Bill Russell really helps that.
You know, to be fair, most of these guys need to not be the best player or need to be in kind of a greater grouping of guys. Like, Isaiah Thomas is arguably the best Piston. He wins the finals MVP in 89, but Joe Dumars gets it in 90. That team has one of the most physically dominant front lines. And that's really how you build a team around a championship point guard, is you have Bill Laimbeer, you have John Sally, you have Rick Mahorn, you have Dennis Rodman. Like, can you ask for more rebounding and defense than those four guys?
The 89 Pistons and really the 90 Pistons, you could write a book, and I'm sure they have written books on...
I own them.
I bet you have, how to build a championship team. They're perfect. In a sense, it goes back to your saying about Kidd, where it's a little disingenuous to say, well, he was the best player on a finals team. Like, yeah, by a little bit, and also they were like one of the most perfectly tailored basketball teams of all time. And that's a little what holds Isaiah Thomas back. You may see that's kind of why I'd rather have Cousy instead. Another thing about Cousy that's kind of underrated, he's dragging basketball by its collar into a watchable, feasible product.
Sure.
Do you know who owns the record for the most free throws made in a basketball game?
Made, so we're ruling out Shaq. If we were just doing attempted, it's either Shaq or Wilt. I still feel like Wilt has a good shot at this.
It's Wilt for the regular season, I believe, but all overall and all time, it's Bob Cousy with 30.
Really?
And the way that happened...
Oh, wait.
30 for this 32. Man, and he scored 50 points.
That is got to be the least watchable basketball game ever.
The way this happened is there was no shot clock, and the Celtics were up, and the other team kept fouling. And Cousy went to the line and knocked him down. And really, you're talking about someone who's making basketball fun in that era.
Yeah.
They aren't even selling tickets.
Oh, man. I just dropped a piece on Hoop Social about the first BAA season, the 46-47 season. And it's wild, everything the Toronto Huskies are trying to do to get basketball. Like, you know, ladies get in free. Buy one, get 8 free tickets. Anybody as tall as our starting center gets in free. Just like, just wild, you know, programs. And they're still struggling. Meanwhile, the Washington Capitals, coached by Red Auerbach, had to like stop doing promos because basketball was thriving in the Capital.
It's a strange time for basketball. So we agree, we have Magic, Steph, Oscar, West, Chris Paul, Cousy, Isaiah Thomas.
Yes. No arguments against Isaiah Thomas being there. You're at number seven. He's who. That's right where I have him. I mean, the guy won the championships in between Magic and Bird and Jordan, and he gets forgotten a lot. I will also say that part of him getting forgotten is that he's nowhere near statistically dominant as either of them or any of those players.
He's inefficient.
He's inefficient. But in Bill Simmons' Book of Basketball, he begins it with this soliloquy of hanging out with Isaiah Thomas at a topless pool in Vegas, and Isaiah giving him the secret to basketball, which is, it's not about basketball. You got to sacrifice. You got to do less. And part of me really likes that because, yeah, it's a team game. If you're out there trying to get all yours, you're not going to win. But the other part of me is like, nah, be better. If you're just better and you get all of yours, your team will win. And like, there's not Magic Johnson being like, I got to do less. Maybe I got to let James Worthy run the offense for a little bit. Magic's just like, I am the best point guard there is. I'm going to do everything that I can. Like Kobe is like, I am the best scorer. I'm going to shoot. Don't even talk to me about passing. And Isaiah's like, well, maybe I got to do off ball and like hang out over here a little bit. So
I've said before, and I think we've probably said the same thing, where there are two kinds of NBA superstars, those that impose their will on the game and those that let the game come to them. And those are both very effective at times. And Isaiah is certainly one of them that lets the game come to him. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Isaiah Thomas is second all time in assists when he retires. Is that true?
I don't know about that.
Or is he third? I think he might be third. I think it's Magic, then Oscar, then him, at least in that by 1994.
That sounds about right.
That's about right, because Stockton wouldn't pass that up for a while, for a little bit at least. But still, I mean, his playmaking was extremely good. He's at least top five by the time he retires.
Yeah, if you look at the guys that are ahead of him, it's Stockton, Kidd, Paul, Nash, Mark Jackson, Magic, LeBron, Oscar. So all of those guys, aside from Oscar and Magic, retire after him. So probably third.
Yeah, I'm happy with Isaiah Thomas at seven.
All right. Who you got at eight?
I had Stockton.
I have Steve Nash.
Okay.
I kind of just was looking at this. Like, Stockton has the best longevity, the greatest long term. But I kind of want a guy that, like, at least at one point was one of the 5 to 10 best players in the league. Like, that kind of matters to me in some ways.
Yeah. I think that's important. Stockton is just so good for so long, but somehow manages to teeter that line between good and great forever. I think in referencing Bill Simmons' book again, he calls Stockton and Nash being in Utah for all that time like having missionary sex for 20 straight years. You are having sex, but it is missionary sex the whole time. And I would think that's what Stockton is.
I mean, that's probably a fair and fine way to look at it.
Ellen, welcome.
What's up?
How's it going?
Not too bad.
Good, good.
You just missed Aaron comparing John Stockton to missionary sex?
That's what he is.
All right.
It's, you are having sex, but at the same time, it's missionary the whole time for 20 years in Utah. It's never that great, but it's there.
No dry spells.
Yes, no dry spells. You're always gonna have a great show every night, but at the same time, think about like, what if you had like Jason Kidd or like Magic Johnson? Steve Nash, that'd be kind of cool. They go behind their back the basketball. 7 point guards all time. Magic, Steph, yeah. Oscar, Wes, Chris Paul, Bob Cousy, and Isaiah Thomas. That's what we did. Very cool stuff.
I like Chris Paul on there.
Yeah, number 5. And we both agreed on that. We didn't have to really think about it. Number 5.
Wow. That's pretty high, isn't it?
I think it's right.
I can't see people put like Gary Payton ahead of Chris Paul.
That's fucking bullshit. That's garbage.
It's almost unanimous. Isaiah Thomas is ranked ahead of Chris Paul.
I push back. I had him ahead of Chris Paul originally when I made my most recent addition of my top 75 players, but I ended up changing it pretty much immediately because I think that's one of the mistakes I made where I got too wrapped up in the titles and Isaiah Thomas just isn't as good.
Mm, yeah. It's like the Derrick Rose effect where like you're the best player on a team that's only good because they're really good at defense. But you're the best offensive player on a team that's only good because it's good at defense.
Really well said. Really well said.
All right. Well, now that Dylan's here, we can actually start the show.
Now that I'm here to slander Derrick Rose.
Are you not a Derrick Rose guy? That's a good point. That was just one of the best defensive teams in the league. And now that you mention it, I have 22 point guards. Derrick Rose is not one of them. And I think that's a thing that's right.
Yeah, let me see here. Because I did get down to ranking. No, I didn't. Nope, didn't make it down to Rose. I thought I did. I saw his name on the list. Yeah, how many more point guards are in between where I stopped ranking the Matrix and Derrick Rose? There are 14 more point guards between where I stopped and where Derrick Rose is.
How many did you get in?
I got 21 in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd go that far, but I understand why the Matrix would cut that short. My number 8 nomination now is Jason Kidd.
Let me see here. All right, we've got some differences. I went with Steve Nash.
Totally flexible with that. I had him in number 9. And that's one of those where I looked at it. I said, you know, if Nate has Nash, I'll roll over. I'll accept it.
Well, that's no fun for the listeners. Let's at least make the case. Tell me why you had Kidd there.
Yeah, sure. Jason Kidd has a 4-year stretch of 4 straight first-team All-NBAs, and he is second MVP voting, barely behind Duncan in 2003. And his winning impact in that era is so clear. Defensively, he is so much better than Steve Nash. And I think for the mid-2000s, that's kind of what was most effective. And you know, obviously, Nash still had his success and still was able to run teams very well. But you could argue Kidd's doing basically the same thing, and in a way, it could be underrated.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I hate judging players entirely by wins and losses. Because like that Steve Nash team before Robert Horry hip checked him and caused the suspensions was well on its way to being a championship team. Like I have little doubt that they would have won had they gotten past the Spurs. And I know that might be a little bit too forgiving to just say, well, if this didn't happen that, but like Kidd had some really easy pathways. I was reading through an article of like, of everyone that Tim Duncan prevented from getting to the finals. Do you want to know how many times Steve Nash lost to Tim Duncan in the playoffs?
I think it's like 5 times.
7 times.
Jeez, man. The Spurs were just a machine of basketball death that strangled the Western Conference for a while.
Absolutely. And so when I look at that, I'm like, oh, why are you not able to get out of the West? It's because you kept playing the Spurs. He loses to the Lakers. He loses to the Mavericks. Like...
I'd say I hold Nash's playoff success at about the same as I do Kidd's.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Then we're discussing the fact that Nash has 2 MVPs, which, you know, we can quibble whether or not they're deserved, but he is the driving force behind all of that offense and really kind of revolutionizes the game. I was also thinking about these guys a lot in kind of concert with Isaiah Thomas and Chris Paul and what you need to win around a small guard who is like a brilliant playmaker and a pretty good scorer. And Isaiah Thomas got that big front line. He got John Sally, Rick Mahorn, Bill Laimbeer, and like they were able to physically bruise people. And if you look at those Nets teams, look at those Suns teams, none of them had it. And it just kind of made me sad to think about, like, you know, we can look at the one time the small guard was successful in winning a championship prior to their era. And the blueprint was there, and both their teams just didn't do it.
They were really close, though. I feel like the breaks kind of fell apart, and they had championship aspirations. I mean, the Nets, I don't think the Nets were beating anyone that came out of the West, really. I mean, even in 2002, let's say the Kings pulled off, we were going to beat the breaks off that Nets team. But yeah.
Sure.
You could argue that Kidd had less help, in a sense, had worse teammates than Nash.
Yeah.
In Phoenix compared to New Jersey.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, when did Mutombo get there?
I mean, he was old. He was old at that point.
Yeah, all right, Mutombo didn't do much for him. I don't know why I remember Mutombo being more impactful on their run, but he's like 11 minutes a night. So we're talking about Sean Marion, Joe Johnson, Quentin Richardson, Amari Stoudemire versus some combination of Kerry Kittles, Vince Carter, Richard Jefferson, and Kenyon Martin. Yeah, Nash had more help, but he also had a much tougher road.
I think at that point it evens out. Are you comfortable going Nash at 8 here?
I am comfortable at Nash at 8. And I have a curveball that kind of breaks from tradition for who I would like to do 9.
Okay.
And but before I tell you who it is, I just want to pull up a number here. I want to talk to you about a player named Jeffrey. We're just going to call him Jeffrey.
Okay, you can call him Jeffrey.
We're going to call him Jeffrey. And Jeffrey had six of these series. In the first, Jeffrey, he averaged 31 points, 11 assists on 55% field goal. Pretty good series, right?
That's great.
Second series, 35 points, 6.5 assists, 52% from the floor. Pretty good, right?
I think that's great.
Third one, 41 points, 8.5 rebounds, 6.3 assists, 50% from the floor.
Who is this? I'm looking at all my names. I am not following. Keep going.
Fourth series, 27 points, 5 rebounds, 4.2 assists, 41.5% from the floor.
Well, it's not Russell. It's not Russell Westbrook. I'll tell you that.
It is not. That, my friend, is Michael Jeffrey Jordan.
Okay.
That fourth playoff series is the one where he went up against Gary Payton. That is a precipitous drop.
Is that where you're headed with this?
That is where I'm headed with this. I've been looking at these lists. I've been, you know, scouring the internet, and Payton is quite commonly left off, or he's in the honorable mentions. If we were to just go straight through the matrix here, let's see, straight through the matrix, Payton ends up behind two other guys that we've still got on this list. If we look at just the writer's poll, which is just an amalgamation of different rankings that, you know, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, Bleacher Report, Slam, like different publications that have at least captured the you know, national attention. Payton is the 12th best point guard, but he is a two-way player, you know, offense and defense. He's not as good of a passer. I almost wish he was listed as a shooting guard, because I feel like if he was a shooting guard, we'd almost consider him higher. I know the shooting guard rankings are much worse. Like after the fifth best shooting guard, it really drops off. But
he'd probably be the fifth, sixth best shooting guard.
Yeah, I mean, it's him or George Gervin and somewhere in there. And we'll get to that. I just don't have that list pulled up right now. But I don't know. I want to at least make the case that Payton's defense and playmaking and scoring outweighs what Jason Kidd could do, outweighs what John Stockton could do, who is just plummeting down these rankings.
I'm in favor of his plummeting. From age 24 to 35, Payton is 20 points per game, 7.5 assists, 4.5 rebounds on 47% shooting. And then they're making the playoffs basically every year, including a few deep playoff runs, like their finals were in 96. I love it personally. I think I like the pick. I like it. I do. I really do.
I'm able to talk you into him over Kidd.
Over Kidd? I thought Kidd was locked in.
Oh, no, no, no.
Okay.
So by my count, we've got Magic at 1, Curry at 2, Oscar at 3, West at 4, Chris Paul at 5, Kuzi at 6, Isaiah Thomas at 7, Steve Nash at 8, and I am arguing for Gary Payton at 9.
Okay, so Steve Nash did get locked in.
Yes.
Okay. Nash got locked in. We did talk about that. One second.
This is the bright side of being the Excel guy. I can kind of just change things around when you're not looking.
That's true. Gary Payton over Jason Kidd. I don't know. I can't quite get there.
All right, push back. Tell me why we're pushing back. You're with conventional wisdom here in saying in that you can't get there. And it is a hard case to make. Like, I don't have a ton of data. I look at that Jordan fall off. You know, his first
fantastic defensive player.
Just one of the best defensive players, and we truly underrate just how meaningful he was at defense. He never gets as close in the MVP rankings. He gets a third place in 98, but
that's still pretty high though for the guys we're talking about.
It is. But we're leaving MVP.
I think for Kidd, there's the 4-year stretch of first team all NBAs that I can't seem to look away from. He is five. We're talking about 5-time all NBA first team, and it's really kind of at the same time that Gary Payton gets his 98 and 2000, then Kidd is 99-2002 for his 4 straight, and then 2004. And he has the same amount of all defensive teams, although only 4 of them are in the first. Also, something to consider, I feel like, man, what do we think about Kidd's role in 2011 versus Peyton's role versus 2006. Do you think that matters at all here?
Oh, Kidd was a much more important player in 2011 than yep. Kidd or than Peyton was in 2006. Like,
not to be mean, but Gary Payton was really bad in 2006. Have you looked back and?
Well, sure. He wasn't great in 2004, and I watched every single game of that Lakers season, or every game that I could, which was probably like 40 of them. Because
he is 37. Yes. I'll give him a break. I obviously do not hold it against him, but he does shoot 36% from the field and averages 2.5 points a game.
Well, and he just plays 24 minutes. Like,
that's a lot. That's a long time.
Well, I've been surprised at how much of this you look at guys and you're just like, let's just boil everything out. How much did your team want to have you on the floor? Like,
that's a good point.
You know, I mean, there's some points where it just doesn't matter. Like, hey, Giannis is more beneficial if he plays 33 versus 36. But even still, we're seeing them try to ramp him up in the playoffs and get him up to that 40. And when I'm just seeing guys that are like supposed to be the lead guys on teams getting like 30 something minutes a night in the playoffs, I question it. And so Peyton getting 24 minutes a night when you're only playing like a 7-man rotation, that's not that great.
Yeah. Kidd in the playoffs averages 38.5 minutes a game. He's basically always out there. Even at the end, it's in the finals, 2011, he averages 37 minutes per night.
Yeah.
That's a lot of minutes. I think I'm going to say, something interesting I'm noticing is Gary Payton's actually won one more playoff game than Jason Kidd. But I'm going to say, let's go Kidd at 8, and we can take Payton at, let's go Kidd at 9. Let's go Payton at 10. What do you think?
I can live with that. That does leapfrog Kidd over John Stockton in my mind or in my rankings, but I'm willing to be okay with that.
Totally fine. Totally fine with that. Should we talk about Stockton?
Yeah.
Should we talk about Stockton now?
Well, is he your number 11, or there's kind of two more guys that you could possibly put into this conversation, and those are Walt Frazier and Russell Westbrook.
Those are the two guys I had as well. I did have Stockton over those two guys. At some point, there is a longevity and a longevity issue with Frazier and an effect in this issue with Russell Westbrook.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd rather have missionary sex for 20 years than have great sex for 7. questionably dangerous sex with Russell Westbrook, where you really question if like your safe words are working. I think that's what it is.
So on the safe word discussion, do you prefer Betty White or pineapple?
I think Betty White works better. And clearly Westbrook doesn't listen to any of the safe words his team has because he just kind of does it every he wants.
I think that's fair. You know, I mean, I would rank them Stockton, Frazier, Westbrook. Westbrook inarguably has the highest peak, has done the most with the role that he's been given. And I should say that all of these guys are either right or are within the top 50 or right outside of it in the matrix. So like, we've gone 13 players deep, and they're all top 50 all-time players. Like, point guard
cards
is a
are important.
Really strong position. Yeah. And
that's exactly the order I had them in. The thing with Westbrook is, at some point, you need to step back and be like, what am I valuing here? What's important in basketball? And can you win a playoff series? Can I trust you in the playoffs? That's what matters. You can dick around in the regular season as much as you want, but if you really buckle down and play well in the playoffs, really all is forgiven. It's kind of the opposite with Westbrook. Like, at some point, I don't really care that he can take a 21 team to 45 wins if that team loses in the first round every time.
I do. I've been thinking a lot about this because we're going to get to shooting guards. And I've been really trying to measure how much do I value being the guy that takes the team to 45 wins versus being, you know, the third option on a team that wins more. And I do think that at some point, you're a better player if you're the best guy on a team that wins 45 games than if you're the third best guy on a team that wins 60 games. But at the same time, we saw Westbrook have the chance to be that second guy, and it was his inability to adapt and to adjust that I'm knocking him for.
Westbrook has shot 39% in the playoffs since 2016. That's not a small sample size. That is his career cut in half. That is the exact, has 800-something games? That doesn't sound right. Whatever his half his career is, that's pretty much what it is. And he's pretty much never been a super effective. And at the same time, like whenever I mention Westbrook on my TikTok page called Possible Chairs, go check that out. People always say, well, he took the Wizards to the playoffs just a year ago. Like, how could you forget that? Yeah, and then he shoots 37% from the field and they lose in the first round in 5.
The Wizards were statistically better with him off the floor.
you run into that thing. You run into this issue where, yeah, Westbrook's going to give you 30, 10, and 10. But at some point when the games matter, you have to kind of relegate him to a smaller role, and that's probably not going to happen. I think I'm comfortable with him having... because Frazier is an insane playoff performer. He consistently played very well. I think he went to 3 straight finals, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. I mean, it really sucks because, like, there's no easy way to split Frazier and get him into the top 10. Like, you are leaving out a staple of a name to, like, leave him off. And you can say he's one of the best defensive guards, but then you gotta have Gary Payton above him. It's really hard to get Frazier into the top 10, so he gets left out of this a lot. But he is closer to top 10 than he will be anyone we talk about after these guys.
I agree. And it gets real interesting after these guys.
So my question as we move out of these guys is, how many more point guards do you have making the top 100 or that you think are at least contenders for the top 100? Like, where does that line stop for you?
I had 22 in total. And okay. I think I may have overdone it on purpose because I really didn't want to miss out on guys. And even this morning I was checking and I'm like, I can't believe I forgot this guy and this guy. So if anything, I have more people than necessary and we can cut it down to a certain amount.
Okay.
How many did you have?
Well, I stopped at 21, but there are a couple of names right outside of there that I couldn't quite parse. And like, I feel bad looking at one of the names. I'm like, he's not in my top 100. But I feel like he's got a case to be there. A lot of it hinges on one award that I'm not entirely sure he should have gotten, but we can get to that.
Is this Dennis Johnson? Are you talking about Dennis Johnson? Yeah, I knew it was Dennis Johnson.
Dennis Johnson.
Okay, so we're sold on Stockton, Frazier, Westbrook in that order.
Yeah,
sounds good. I had Damian Lillard, number 14.
Okay, so in the Matrix, Damian Lillard came in as the 15th best point guard, just 2 total spots behind Tiny Archibald. So I'm going to guess Archibald is your 15th?
That's true. Archibald's my 15th. We are on fire.
What was your breakdown of why Lillard over Archibald?
Lillard doesn't have an insane playoff resume, but at the same time, Archibald has these first-team NBA appearances. He has the 30 points. They led the league in points and assists 1 year, if I remember correctly. He only makes the playoffs one time in Kansas City. And while it's difficult to make the playoffs in that era, you can say X, Y, and Z, that hurts. He's putting up these numbers, a team's winning 35 games, and at least Dame goes to the playoffs and really plays very well in them. That was honestly pretty much the only difference. Also, there is a longevity thing. Dame has been really good for a long time.
I mean, just the way the Matrix looks at people is it does take some career totals into consideration. And when they're two spots away from each other, but Dame still has more of his career left, like, I doubt he's going to have another one of his top 5 seasons. Doubt he's going to have another top 3 year. He might have another one of the 10 best years of his career. But, like, he's not going to really massively change, but he could continue to build that legacy. So I'm totally fine with Lillard over Archibald. I mean, the 30 points, 10 assists is both impressive and just kind of sad. Like, you know, we talk about Westbrook doing triple-doubles and not always paying off. And that... It really doesn't pay off for Tiny Archibald. And you look at the rest of his team, and I kind of wonder how he got the 10 assists, in all honesty, because the rest of that team is not good.
Not good. Yeah, and maybe we're not accounting for that in the sense we're holding his playoff or lack of playoff success against him, but I don't necessarily blame him. That team probably wildly overachieved, if anything. Also, coached by Bob Cousy. Pretty cool stuff.
That could not have been fun. I do not feel like Bob Cousy would be a fun man to play for.
Now that you mention it, yeah, probably not.
Like, if I had to make a list of the worst NBA legends to play for, Cousy's got to be in that top 10.
I think Bill Russell would probably be one of them. Not to be... He coached the Kings for a while. I think his standards are so high. I've never heard horror stories, but his standards have to be so high that if... He must have just given up. And for all accounts, I heard that he basically did. In his time coaching the Kings, he just kind of read the newspaper during practice because he's like, this isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, I have a hard disagreement with him being inducted in the Hall of Fame as a coach. Like, I get it. First black coach. That's historic.
Absolutely.
That doesn't mean he was good at it. Like, as soon as he stopped coaching himself, he just was a terrible coach, which just tells me that he's an amazing player.
His first season, he's the player coach is 67 and they lose. They're outmatched that year. And he ends up getting some assistant coaches to essentially deal with substitutions because it obviously playing the entire game and trying to keep track of substitutions became too much for him. And then they win the next two titles.
Have you ever heard Kenny talk about playing for Bill Russell?
I have on the bus. I've heard about that story. Yeah.
Well, for the listeners that haven't heard the Bill Russell, Kenny, the Jet Smith, Kenny gets on the bus as a rookie. And Bill's like, you're going to come sit by me. He's like, oh man, why am I going to sit by Bill? And Bill's like, listen, everyone else on this team is a loser. Don't talk to them. Don't interact with them. They all suck. And I don't want them to get their loser stink on you.
That's essentially the mindset he had. I have a newspaper article saved from the Sacramento Bee detailing his time coaching the team.
Is it favorable?
No.
Didn't think so.
No, it's not.
All right. But we got more point guards to discuss for who could possibly be top 100. I've got a cluster of these next guys. Which is really interesting because it actually has quite a range in the matrix. But I really love kind of the similarity of my next three. And I'm not going to give them to you in order. I'm just going to try to go alphabetically.
Mm-hmm. We're stuck on, really quickly, we're good on Dame 14, Archibald 15.
Yes.
Sounds perfect.
All right. So these were the next three up for me. And they are, in alphabetical order, Kevin Johnson, Kyrie Irving, and Tim Hardaway Sr.
Interesting. I did not include Tim Hardaway.
You did not include Tim Hardaway Sr.
I did not include. I feel like I should have. That's someone I thought about, but probably should have looked more into. Can I offer my number 16 guy that's not either one of those guys?
Yeah, sure.
Just for thought. I had Lenny Wilkins at 16.
Mm-hmm. Lenny Wilkins did not make my top 21.
He should have. Totally should have.
Okay. Talk to me about Lenny Wilkins, and I'm going to talk to you about Kevin Johnson.
Wilkins is a 9-time All-Star. He's a 1-time assist champ. He never makes an All-NBA team, mostly because he plays behind Oscar and West the entire time.
Okay, that's two.
That's two.
Yeah, who are the other two guards?
I'm not entirely sure who the other two guards are.
This is like the thing that I hate, is people are like, yeah, Reggie couldn't make All-Star teams, but he was behind Michael Jordan. I'm like, yeah, sure. And like...
there are other people. Just... I understand. It is Cousy making it every year for the first half, and then Hal Greer was... I think Hal Greer was like 9-time straight second team on NBA.
Okay.
So him, and then it looks like Sam Jones, essentially.
Pretty stiff competition.
Yeah, pretty much. Man, I didn't think Lenny Wilkins would be a hot topic. I should have prepared. For assists per game, he led league 1 time. It also has 1, 2, 3, 4 second place finishes and 2 third place finishes. So he's always up there. In assists, now, he doesn't win a ton of playoff games, but he is 31 and 33 in the playoffs and plays fairly well in them. I he's in the NBA's top 75. I figured at least in the top 100, to be fair.
Yeah.
Not sold. Don't like Lenny Wilkins. That's interesting.
No, I mean, you know, the way that you and I both like looking at win shares is based on doubling playoff win shares.
That's true.
Because like that's what really matters here. And you know, it's not uncommon for a guy to have like 17 regular season win shares and have like 3 or 4 in the playoffs. And if we look at Lenny Wilkins and his career numbers, he comes in 132nd in career win shares.
That's true.
His best win share season, doubling for playoffs, 347th.
That's not great. It's not looking good for my Lenny Wilkins case.
It's not. If we look at how I rebuilt the matrix, which gives you a point and a quarter, actually, yeah, a point and a quarter for assists. Actually, no, it's a point and a half, a full point and a half for assists, 1 point for points. And at that time period, like 0.9 for a rebound. His top combined averages come out 100th best.
Hey, 100. Check it out. That's what we're looking for.
Okay, his peak counting stats, 100, his peak win shares, 347th. So, like, let's split the difference and meet somewhere in that range.
Not as ideal, you know. I'll back away from that. At that point, okay. No Lenny Wilkins. That's too bad.
I mean, you know what are we even really talking about here? Lenny Wilkins' career 6.7 assists, 16.5 points per game.
It's a different era.
It's a different era. It's an incredibly fast era that people should be scoring more. Assists are much harder to come by.
He did not score a lot.
He didn't score much. And like, to be fair, they've invented the all defensive teams, in 69. So he's 31. But I've never heard people really rave about the great defense of Lenny Wilkins.
Maybe I can make something up right now. Tell you how good he was defensively.
go for it. And maybe you can make something up about like how great one of his teammates were that was really carrying the team. He's got Cliff Hagin, he's got some of the tail end of Bob Pettit. You know, it's just like, what? He's an
athlete. Totally fair.
He's fine.
He's all right. All right. Okay. I get it. Let me hear your argument for your nomination. You have three of them. I think of all of those guys, I'm most interested in Kyrie. So you shot down, just ripped to pieces my Lenny Wilkins suggestion.
Absolutely.
Who do you have in his place?
In his place, I have Kevin Johnson.
I like Kevin Johnson. Kevin Johnson's someone I had actually forgotten about when I originally made this and added earlier this morning. I'm like, totally forgot about KJ.
See, Kevin Johnson was like on a path to being really good. And he never quite got there. He had some injury issues back half of his career. You start seeing those games played drop from the 70s, 49, 67, 47, 50. Like it falls off. He's got injuries. But part of me really wants this list. I value like a 5-year peak, I think, more than anything else. Like the one and done type of guys I'm not super into. And the guys that are like pretty average for 20 years, I'm also not into. Like I want someone that really meant something.
They had a hold, like a hold on the NBA for at least a little bit.
Yeah. And so he tops out as, you know, 3 straight All-NBA second teams, gets a third team, then gets another second a little bit away. But I just want to read you the guys that are in the All-NBA teams his years.
Okay.
So starting in 89, the guys that finish ahead of him in the voting.
Sounds like Michael Jordan.
Magic Johnson, John Stockton, then Kevin Johnson. That's a pretty, like, we are talking about 2 top 10 players in NBA history, and one mileage varies. We're lower on Stockton, but general consensus is top 35 guy. Like, that's solid.
A good sign for him is he's competing against the guys that are ahead of him are guys that we are ranking ahead of him. So it's not like he is underperforming in a sense.
Sure. The second year, he's behind Magic, Michael, John Stockton. So he's the fourth guy on the team. But ahead of Joe Dumars, who would win finals MVP in 90, and Clyde Drexler, who would take the Blazers to the finals. The third year, he's behind Michael, Magic, ahead of Drexler, John Stockton, and Joe Dumars again. It's a short period, but I think I value those 3 years a lot more than anyone else. And I don't care that he didn't quite have as much success. He makes the finals. He doesn't have particularly great finals. But I really value his just stranglehold on the position for those couple of years and really being a top player.
Even with that being said, and the games start to drop off from age 22 to 30, which is 88 to 97, he's 20 points per game and 10 assists on 49% shooting. So his effectiveness is still there, even if the games played starts to fall off a little bit. I'm okay with that. I like Kevin Johnson. He was our mayor for a little bit.
Oh, really?
Or something. I'm pretty sure. I remember seeing him in the paper a lot. He was the 55th mayor of Sacramento. Kevin Johnson was the 55th mayor of Sacramento. Yeah, he was.
Impressive.
Yeah, as far as I know, pretty good mayor.
Watch him actually have been like a terrible mayor with a huge scandal, but just neither of us were that involved in politics during the time.
He slipped under our nose. All right, so are we good with Kevin Johnson sneaking in?
Yeah, yeah, I am 100% there with Kevin Johnson.
I'm sold. I'm all in. So we're on to number 17.
Can I interest you in a Tim Hardaway Sr.?
It's either him or Kyrie. I think that's where I'm at. And you could convince me that, yeah, Tim Hardaway should be on there.
And Tim Hardaway has a fairly similar case in there of just like he had this really high peak at one point. I'm a basketball book junkie because you can't transport yourself back. Like, I hate trying to retroactively look back and be like, ah, this player would have had this or that. And I really appreciate reading things that were written in the time period of just like how people felt about Tim Hardaway and how people felt about different players. So from the 1991-92 Basketball Almanac, which sold for $5.95 in the day and had 300 NBA players, like, it's a beautiful little...
Looks amazing.
This is the analysis that they have on Tim Hardaway Sr. Tim Hardaway looks like a future superstar, especially with name point guards like Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, that now in their 30s. He has all this, could be another player of magnitude. All Hardaway needs to show is the ability to lift a team to a higher level. His career is off to a flying start.
I think
that's
at that point,
into his career.
And they were really right. Really, only a knee injury in '94. He missed the whole season. Derails that. Also, only winning 21 playoff games his whole career. Kind of stings.
It does, but I feel like at this point, you know, if people want to start arguing, there's a lot of guys. This, I think, is where it really opens up, and you start putting a high number of different guys in these spots. But Tim was on that ascension path. Tim was actually going to be one of those guys. And the Run TMC Warriors are like a staple of early 90s basketball. And so I kind of give him the historical nod. I mean, if you want to make a case for Kyrie, I'll listen.
I'm good. I'm good.
Just the personal dislike of Kyrie keeps him lower for you.
It's not a personal dislike. I feel like there's so much Kyrie hype that it's my responsibility to be reasonable about him. I also want to reflect quickly that Hardaway recently apologized profusely and sincerely about some past comments he had made. And I thought that was a really big step for him. I worried that he was going to own those up until forever, essentially. But and I think if you look into it, he's been just one of the most active people in the LGBT community for a long time because of what he said. He said he hates gay people, for the listeners. And he said a lot more than that. But
he's had some horrible homophobic comments, but also has done the work since then, post-playing career. You know, kind of out of the spotlight sort of stuff. So, like, I don't know. You and I, we're both Jewish. How do you feel about Myers Leonard?
I don't really care, but he shouldn't. What did he even say? What did he do? I honestly forgot what he did.
So, I'll bleep this
editing.
Does he say
that blur on playing COD or something?
Yeah, so I'll bleep this during editing. He was playing COD and trying to kill someone, and he said, "Die, you damn cunt."
That's fucking, oh my god. Who says that? Not that I'm like, oh, I don't take offense to it, but it's just a ridiculous slur that no one uses anymore. Hello?
His response to like people questioning him using that slur was, oh, well, I have a lot of friends that are in the military or police, and that's what they say. I was like, dude.
Oh, that's not good either. Oh, man. All right. I don't think Myers Leonard's making our top 100.
Well, I'm just saying all of this because Myers Leonard met with a rabbi and did a fair amount of work and then kind of threw that work away. Some of his other comments have been like, oh, yeah, you know, these owners just don't want to hire me because they're worried about public perception and, you know, kind of stop doing the work. And just to juxtapose that, Tim Hardaway has done the work and he's done it in quiet and hasn't made like a big.
Absolutely. Good guy, Tim Hardaway. He's raised in unfortunate circumstances that led to some internalized homophobia, and he has done really a lot to reverse that.
Yeah.
All right. We got Kevin Johnson at 16. Kyrie Irving?
Tim Hardaway at 17. Are we willing to lock him in, or do you want to argue someone over him?
Tim Hardaway at 17. I am sold.
Good. All right. Who else you got?
How about Tony Parker? Four championships.
Four championships, four All-NBA, six-time All-Star. One-time finals MVP.
He has three straight All-NBA second teams where he's behind Kobe and Chris Paul for all of those, if I remember correctly. He's arguably the second best point guard in the league during that stretch. But that says more about the time period, you could argue, but extremely good playoff performer. It's the anti-Russell Westbrook. You know Tony Parker's going to play well in the playoffs, and he has some really great playoff moments. You know Tony Parker has a higher career, I don't know how to phrase this, has a higher career high in a playoff series than Kyrie Irving.
Does he really?
He does. 29.6 versus 29.4.
Oh, then that's not career high. I was thinking like a single game.
I have not checked on that. I don't think that's true. But it's in a playoff series. So.
Well, Tony did drop a 55-pointer in the playoffs. I did not realize that.
Has Kyrie? 55. Who did he do that against? When was that?
It was 2009. Let me grab that game here.
Tony Parker was on the cover of NBA Live 07. He was 08 or something. That tells you something. He was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, Devin Booker's the cover of the current one. I'm sorry. The 55 was a regular season game. 43 is his playoff career high.
Okay. And I think Kyrie has that be.
You know, I do have Kyrie over him. And I actually have Chauncey Billups over him as well.
Oh, over Tony Parker?
I feel like his finals MVP is maybe more deserved.
Sure.
But like also Billups led teams. And Billups, I never feel like Tony is close to Tim Duncan. is, hey, the gap between Tony and Tim Duncan is much larger than whoever Billups and his next best guy was. But I really do look at, like, hey, Duncan carried these teams, and Parker and Monty were good. They're nice complementary pieces. In the same way that, like, Clay and Draymond are complementary pieces, but, like, Curry is a transcendent star or among stars. Like, I hold Tony Parker's success against him, or not his success, but his teammates against him, and I feel like he kind of just rode coattails.
You don't think he's the best player on the 2013 Spurs? Totally possible. Led them in scoring, led them in assists, led them in win shares.
Yeah. And what did they do?
Well, you could argue that they would have won And Duncan is really good in the finals, though.
Duncan kind of knew how to pace himself. And, like, hey, he was going to let Manu and Tony run around and score. And he was going to captain the defense. And when he needed to, like, he's 36 years old at that point. Tony is a true second fiddle. Tony is, you know.
You need second fiddles, though. That's something you can't. At some point, a really good second fiddle winning four titles is going to overvalue. Sure.
I don't know. I think these guys are all really close, because these guys are all probably more seconds than firsts. I do think Kyrie's bag, and I hate the fact that I just had to say that. Kyrie is just a crazy efficient scorer. I mean, we're talking, like, during his peak, like, you know, last four or last six playoff runs, he's basically 60% true shooting. Tony Parker, even with Duncan there, we're talking, like, topping out at 55% true shooting. Like, he's okay. They get scoring.
It's a different era a little bit, and Parker never really had to shoot threes or be good at them to be super effective. You could argue that Parker is a better finisher around the rim than Kyrie Irving. He, in an era where that was extremely important.
Well, that's why I try to rely more on true shooting, because, like, it helps balance some of those differences between a guy jacking a bunch of threes and a guy, you know, getting to the rim. It's about efficiency there.
I'm sold on Kyrie at 18.
Okay. Why do you have Parker above Billups? Because I can go back and forth on these two. The Matrix does have Parker 36 spots above Billups. This just might be a little bit of my Michigan bias.
Billups made one All-NBA second team and two third teams. Parker has three second teams and one third team. And whether it's not a huge difference, I feel like the elite years for Parker are there, where you look at him as really one of the best players in the league. I don't think you see that for Billups. That's kind of the argument. You go against just who had the elite seasons. I would take Tony Parker. Does Tony Parker ever have any MVP votes? He has a fifth place finish in 2012. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that when I was doing this research.
How high does Billups go? Billups has a fifth place finish in 2006, so it's a wash, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, both their playoff records are really impeccable. Tony, extreme longevity. Billups making Eastern Conference Finals after Eastern Conference Finals as the best player on the Pistons. Maybe arguably, like, I do also really value Ben Wallace's contributions. They're probably 1A, 1B.
Their stats are exactly the same. Oh my God.
Yeah, they are incredibly similar. And I kind of tossed back and forth, because the difference between the two of them in my Matrix really are those awards. As far as just, like, statistical performances, they're really close. Billups actually comes out ahead because he has a greater win shares or peak and different points in his career. Like, those 2006, Billups has, in the regular season, 15.5 win shares, and in the playoffs, another 2.7. Tony Parker's best season by win shares, which is not what I want this podcast to be, so it's just rattling off numbers, but his best, you know, won by win shares is 9.6.
Yeah, the win shares love Billups. I think my final case is there's more, the higher peak for Parker, the three extra rings.
It's the two extra rings.
It's the three extra rings.
Parker only has three rings.
No, he doesn't. No, he has four.
You're right, he has four. I've seen a ring.
2003,
5, 7,
oh my
gosh. 14. Yeah, I'm going crazy.
when you look at the basketball reference pages and Wikipedias for hours on end, it just melts your mind.
Yeah.
Tony Parker, number 19.
All right.
He is in, ladies and gentlemen.
How many more guys you got? Because if we do Parker at 19, can we lock Billups in at 20? Or you got guys you want to argue over Billups? And
I have just one name, because I think I decided Dennis Johnson should be, like, the last 22nd point guard. We could just, maybe if we get to the point in the full top 100, we need someone, maybe Dennis Johnson to be that guy. How about Dave Bing?
Why?
I like Dave. You hate old point guards. Dave Bing is a 7-time All-Star, 3-time All-NBA. It's interesting. Basketball Reference credits him with a scoring title. He did not win that scoring title. I don't know why they give it to him. Oscar Robertson averaged more points. I don't understand why that's the case.
Did Oscar have not enough games played?
Let me double check. Mother, 1 second.
In general, I'm not as big of a fan of trying to tally up how many All-Stars a guy had when there are 10 teams. In that time, they had 20 All-Stars for 10 teams. So every team got 2 All-Stars. And that's, I think, something that people miss a lot when they talk about, like, oh, Bill Russell had this stacked team. He had all these All-Stars or all these Hall of Famers. Well, there's only so many teams. So you just, there was a sudden number of All-Stars. Like, I think All-Stars got better. So when we're talking about Dave Bing being a 7-time All-Star, but only 3-time All-NBA, that hurts him in my mind. Also, I feel that entire era from 68 to 76 is not a great era for basketball because you've got the two leagues. And so I almost look at it as being like an Eastern Conference All-Star and a Western Conference All-Star, but there's 20 of them on each conference. So you have 40 players making All-Star teams. You have 10 players making All-NBA first team, 10 players making All-NBA second team, 2 MVPs, 2 championships. And so like that era in particular, I really question a lot of the awards and I deduct points for them because you can't have 40 All-Stars in a season when there's like 18 teams.
I think that's totally fair. I understand now why he won that scoring title. It's because they had yet to move to averages and he had the most points.
Oh.
Which is how they should have kept it. And it was stupid that they changed it. he also has 2 first team All-NBA selections in 68 and 71 and a second team in 1974. But I hear what you're saying. I think as a top 100 player, Bing is fair to consider. But if you want to wait on that, I'm okay. In that case, you want to go Billups and then Bing? Or did you have somebody else in mind?
I would say as a Michigander, I would go Billups then Bing.
You're just going to throw that out there? That Dave Bing played for the Pistons the whole time? Not going to represent?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I'm going to say, like, as a Michigander, I would take
makes sense.
Take Billups over Bing. Like, you know, I feel like that's kind of the consensus, even among some of the old heads this year.
I'm all for it. That leaves us with Dennis Johnson at 22, essentially. Or did you have somebody else in mind?
No, I do think you talked me into Bing. I like Bing over Dennis Johnson. One of the things, I was really looking into Dennis Johnson's, his finals MVP. Because ideally, this should be a really tough season and to win, like, right post-merger, you know, 2 years after the merger. Like, this should be an incredibly hard thing to do. And I look at that team, and I look at a guy like Gus Williams, and I'm like, man, there's a pretty equal case that you could say Gus Williams deserves finals MVP. And I thought a lot about Gus Williams and where Gus would rank. And Gus actually doesn't rank that much further back on these things, in my mind.
The entire era is a disaster, and I want to wipe it off the face of the earth, just erase it from the record books. It never happened. There was no merger. They just skipped right to Magic Johnson.
It's one of the most competitive basketball's ever been, and there's just so much talent in the league immediately post-merger because you allowed a lot of players to develop, and then you condense the rosters down that the league hasn't settled in yet, and you do have these kind of wild upsets. Like, teams are not quite what you think because guys are still figuring out how to play. There was a huge stylistic difference. Like, imagine if you could have basketball, you know, you start off with the same rules in 68 and then you come back a decade later and see the differences. Like, imagine if you split the NBA and one team, like, one style continued to play like the Spurs and the other style like figured out the three-pointer like Steph Curry, and just like the whole stylistic difference when you smashed them back together. That's kind of that early post-merger.
It's such an interesting time because it's not necessarily harder for the players, but it's just harder for the teams, I think. I'm not even really sure what to deduct from it. I don't think we're ever going to see something like that. It was like basketball boiled down to its purest form and just anyone could win. And that's why the Wizards won a title. That's what it takes for the Wizards to win a championship. And it's a mistake that never should have happened. All right. I think we're good on point guards. Would you like to read our 22 top 100 candidates for point guards?
Well, I just want to name one more name and see how you feel about them.
Please, please.
That Seattle Supersonics team was the last team in the Western Conference to win the championship that wasn't from either Texas or California?
Jeez. I have a name as well that I'd like to mention. I wonder if we're thinking of the same person.
Are you thinking, there's two names that it could be, and they're both really similar cases. Are you thinking of Derrick Rose or Penny Hardaway?
I wasn't thinking of either of those guys, but I like, oh man, Penny Hardaway is a good one.
Okay. Who are you thinking of?
I was thinking of Mark Price. Yeah. First team on NBA, 1993.
Price is really interesting because, like, there's an argument that he's one of Jordan's tougher competitions during that first three-peat.
I'm in favor of putting Penny Hardaway above Dennis Johnson.
I had him there. You know, it's very similar to a Tim Hardaway Sr. And it's very similar to a Derrick Rose of, like, these short-lived players. Penny's a four-time All-Star. That fourth All-Star appearance, he played just 19 games but gets in on the fan vote because that is how highly he was regarded. And, like, yeah, it's a popularity contest, whatever. Allen Iverson gets in off of, like, next to zero games his last year. But, like, in general, to capture the hearts and minds of the fans, like, to get in off of doing nothing, you have to be really good.
I agree. He has two first-team All-NBA appearances and a third-team All-NBA and four All-Star appearances. And then his career is just crushed by injuries. And I think I like his launch angle better than I do Tim Hardaway's. But it didn't last for as long.
Yeah. Tim Hardaway was able to recover the career and get back to being an All-Star a couple of times.
He was first team All-NBA in 1987, Hardaway.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange? After all of that, his technically ticked by accolades, his best season was then. Dennis Johnson, is that my reading? Dennis Johnson was first team All-NBA in 1981. Did you know that?
I didn't. I don't have these things memorized.
How we do? I figured you do. Some of these you do. First team All-NBA in 1981 and second team in 1980. Six-time All-Defensive, first team, three-time All-Defensive, second team, five-time All-Star, three-time champion. Now I'm going back. We're going back and forth on two guys that probably aren't going to even make it. I'm just going to type them in. We can just go, our 23rd guy is Penny Hardaway. Are you okay with that? Or did you want Derrick Rose?
No. I listen, the thing for Rose is Rose's single year is better than probably the last, I don't know, everyone until we get back up to Westbrook. So Rose's best year is better than the last 11 guys we've talked about. And his second best year is pretty average in every other comparison. And his third best year is, like, not even on the map with these guys. And this is maybe my own personal biases, but I don't care about that flash in a pan. You can write the history of the NBA and never mention Derrick Rose.
Totally true. You can. No, you can't. He's the youngest MVP ever. You got to say that.
So?
They kind of, okay, I understand that. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. That's, we're going to get back to this when we do our centers and talk about Bill Walton. We're not huge fans of guys that had an immense peak for one season, for two seasons. That's not what teams are built on. That's not what dynasties are built on. And really, it's not what champions are built on. You have to have five-year stretches where you're one of the best players in the league for anything to really come of it.
This might sound blasphemous. I'm not entirely sure I can hold true to this take, but I'd be tempted to rank Joakim Noah higher than Derrick Rose because of what his impact was for Chicago and his longevity.
Wow. I don't know if I can go that far. I don't know if I'm there. I think in a vacuum, you are right. Joakim Noah had more impact for the Bulls than Derrick Rose did. That's insanity. And you know why I know that? Is because my grandma, who only processes basketball games through newspaper articles and watching them, she is, like, the purest form of basketball knowledge you could ever have. Influenced by no internet takes, by no TikTok videos, she remembers Joakim Noah more than Derrick Rose.
I looked them up in the Matrix, and Rose is 100 spots ahead of Noah, but when you think of the Tibbs era Bulls, and that's the thing, is you say the Tibbs era Bulls because you can't say the Rose era Bulls because it wasn't an era. It was a couple of seasons. Joakim Noah had a longer lasting impact and is the more recognizable guy from that era. Rose is just a constant what if. And also, to be fair, I don't like talking about Rose without bringing up the fact that he's a horrible human being.
He did sexually assault some people.
And on the stand, when asked if he knew what the definition of consent was, he said, I don't know.
It's not good.
Yeah, I had a friend that's law school that was like, well, that's what your coach to say. I'm like, I don't fucking care. Like, he's not getting anything for it. You could at least try to, like, you know, feign human decency and be like, yes, I'm aware. I felt I had consent. something, just saying you don't know what consent is just one of the most trash human being takes I can ever have. So we'll put that out there.
We can leave it there. We are done with the point guards. Check it out. We are all done with the point guards. Yeah. We've got the 23 potential top 100 candidates. I can try to read it out. We had Magic, Steph Curry, Oscar, Jerry West, Chris Paul, Bob Cousy, Isaiah Thomas, Steve Nash, Jason Kidd, Gary Payton, John Stockton, Walt Frazier, Russell Westbrook, Damian Lillard, Tiny Archibald, Kevin Johnson, Tim Hardaway, Kyrie Irving, Tony Parker, Chauncey Billups, Dave Bing, Dennis Johnson, and Penny Hardaway. I'm a fan.
I'll put Lenny Wilkins in there for 24 just for your sake.
Woo! Lenny Wilkins.
Well, and like, there's still a lot of really good point guards that are left on the board. I mean, just looking at the matrix, the next couple of guys up, I'll go ahead and just read off the next 12 because they're all still top 150, are Jimmy Jones, Larry Jones, Matt Calvin, Darren Williams, Louis Dampier, Gilbert Arenas, Mark Price, Gus Williams, Kyle Lowry, JoJo White, Luka Doncic, and Derrick Rose.
Man, Luka's in it. I didn't even think of Luka.
Listen, Luka...
Are we just saying we're not going to touch it? We're not going to touch it because he's only been in the league for like 2 years.
I mean, if you want to look at his peak and his accolades, Luka should be above Rose. Luka should be probably above Penny. A lot of these guys, I think Luka will get there. So I'm not really concerned about Luka.
Yeah.
Hey, we do this next year after Luka's won a title. Sure, Luka's in that top 13 group, that cluster.
I genuinely refuse to rank players that have not played for at least like 7 years.
It used to be a requirement of my matrix that you played at least 5 years. Cause it just gets all sorts of wonky. Like someone asked me to show kind of what the rookie rankings were. I was like, oh yeah, Scottie Barnes, like 1,666th, like Cade Cunningham, because he missed a bunch of games in the beginning and then like slowly ramped into shape, like 2000. It's just such a small sample size in the longevity of the NBA history that these rankings are so subjective, but it was kind of nice the fact that I rerun these matrix every year, that I started in 2013 and I've watched Giannis go from that like 1,000, you know, 500 mark into top 30. Like it's been fun to watch him rise.
You're very lucky to have that kind of view.